Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Happy Tuesday for many of you out there that are on the roads this morning. Be careful because I would imagine it is rough going, especially here in the upper Midwest and Hartford as well. They're getting a bunch of snow coming, I believe, tomorrow. Hebrews 10:23 says, "Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful." And I pray that we aren't unswervingly on the road as we're driving, going to work or wherever you're headed this morning. Be careful. Ellendale, North Dakota, 19 inches of snow. That is going to be some serious shoveling, snow blowing, and plowing. Good luck to you folks in Ellendale and North Dakota. In general, this kind of travel advisory, the state's kind of quieted down today. So if you're home, just enjoying the radio and maybe catching up on some reading or some work around the house. Maybe it's just a snow day. I loved snow days when I was a kid. I just never had enough of them, but I sure liked them. All right, here's something I found interesting. A certain pizza company is making ordering pizza easy and fashionable. This pizza chain is rolling out a new high-top sneaker that orders pizza. They're pie tops. They're revealed Monday, just this week, and they feature this Bluetooth technology that allows you, when you're wearing these shoes, to order pizza by pressing a button on the shoes. All right. Just how lazy are you? You can also reach for your phone, can't you? Anyway, the shoes will pair with the owner's smartphone and order up your pizza. And that way it can also confirm your order and your address. All right. Sounds gimmicky to me. Anyway, Dr. David Stevens is with us, and Dr. Paul Kengor. That's going to be our hour. It's going to be a good one. So let me take a quick break. It's 6 minutes after, and when we come back, Dr. David Stevens will be with us. It is 8 minutes after the hour, and the doctor is in. The good doctor is in. Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So nice to hear your voice.
Well, it's good to be here. I was thinking about your pizza comment. You know, you won't work off the calories for your pizza by reaching down and touching your tennis shoes. Let me clue you in.
I agree. All right, David. Washington, the state of Washington, is getting ready to, what, legalize the womb, and you can sell babies now.
Yeah, it's a new law that's just passed called Uniform Parentage Act, and they expect the governor to sign it, and there's a lot of concern about it because essentially they're legalizing selling your womb and commercializing the womb. People can charge for you having having your baby. They don't have to have any biological connection to you. It's taking surrogacy, this whole concept of using someone else's womb, a woman's womb, to have a baby, to a whole new level. They don't have to be a citizen of or a resident of Washington. They can be from anywhere in the world. There's no limit on how much they can pay, no limit on how many babies they can have produced, no requirement that they go through any kind of adoption procedures. It's just a huge issue that this state's gone further than anyone else and going to have a lot of concerns of what's going to happen to these children.
Let me just remind our listeners or let them know that this Uniform Parentage Act was strictly along party lines. Every Democrat voted in favor and every Republican opposed. So there's not an ounce of bipartisanship on this one. Tell me some of the implications, David, you see on this, besides the obvious ones.
Well, I mean, this whole idea of there's no limits. There's a 28-year-old Japanese billionaire who went to Thailand to an American-owned fertility clinic and had 13 babies produced. And he's going to do 10 to 15 babies per year, he says, before he dies. He's not even married. Mm-hmm. And he just decided he wanted to have hundreds of children and support them. So this type of thing, there's a story of two homosexual men that were convicted of having a surrogate baby boy, and then they were pedophiles and passed him around to other men. And so, you know, the fact that we just make having children just something that is a commercial thing, they're going to make money from it. All you have to do in Washington is at least have one doctor visit in the state. Otherwise than that, there's no regulation at all. So one gets full authority over vulnerable babies. All you have to do is show a, quote, an intent to parent. You can be single, married, maybe even more than a couple involved, where it could be three, four, five parents for one child. And this violates the Hague Convention on International Adoption that's been adopted by over 70 nations. And, you know, putting a young child in a home where there's a male that is not the husband of a woman is the greatest predictor of child abuse. So these aren't just, you know, innocent things. This is going to affect a lot of kids and the rush to do, you know, do whatever makes you feel good in the state of Washington.
Now, David, let me back up to a point you made just a minute ago, and that is that this bill is going to basically hand to the government and give them authority over this little vulnerable baby. They're going to have a significant say as to this kid's life, and it's not going to be the biological parents. It's going to be the state government.
Well, when we go through a normal adoption procedures, there's screening of the parents in the home and making sure that this child's going to go into a good atmosphere and a good environment, and that they're going to do a good job raising them. And at least these adopted parents, you know, have desired to have children, most often, though not now, as much as used to be, are married. You can adopt as a single parent, and there are some good single parents out there, but, you know, those restrictions have decreased. But this essentially is commercializing. It's going to be taking advantage of poor women. You have my baby and care it for you, and I'll pay you $50,000. And this becomes a business of having children. And, yes, we'll pay your medical expenses. In the past, what it's been is, you know, we'll pay your medical expenses, but there's no remuneration for doing it. It's done out of altruism. But now it's just, well, we'll pay you and induce you to do it. This is happening overseas, as we heard about in Thailand, where poor women are induced to do this. And some of them do multiple pregnancies, and this becomes their business, having children for rich people. Surrogacy also raises all sorts of other issues. We've expressed in our ethics statement on CMDA.org on reproductive technology that there's only rare occasions where surrogacy may be justified, and because adoption's another option. For example, if someone had undergone in vitro fertilization and then the woman had a hysterectomy and couldn't bear the child or her children, a sister or someone like that may do that out of love and care for her sister. But surrogacy, there's a bonding between the mother carrying the baby that's not the biological parent, and that runs into issues, and there have been court cases over that. I want to keep the child. It's just a lot of issues. And we see this in the Old Testament as well with, you know, Abraham and Sarah, and she had a baby by her maid and all the issues that caused. That's human nature. So there's victims often in surrogacy situations, not all of them, but in many of them. But definitely to sell your womb, for rent it for your room is not something we want to do.
Yeah. David, is this going to will this catch on in other states, or do you think this is going to be Washington state only?
California has a similar law. Other states are moving towards it. It's becoming the norm. Essentially, you know, it's the me first. I want a child.
Well, right.
And I'll pay for it, and you need to let me have it. So anyway, I want to get it.
I don't like that. All right, I'm going to go to break just a minute early here, and I just want to let parents know that when we return to the conversation, I'm going to have a little bit of a sensitive conversation about teens with Dr. Stevens. So you may want to turn the volume down just a little bit for a couple of minutes or check out the podcast a little bit later. I just want to be super sensitive to all the parents out there with young teens. It's 15 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break, and then when we return, more with Dr. David Stevens. It is 17 minutes after the hour. I'm talking to Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. And right before the break, I gave a little heads up that the nature of this next conversation might be a little sensitive, especially if you have teens. So just a fair warning. Dr. Stevens, I see that this subject of teens that are sexting quite a bit nowadays, and the statistics are frighteningly high, and 1 in 7 teens reported sending a sext. This can't be good.
It's not. This new study out of JAMA, and they looked at over 110,000 teens from 39 different studies and found one, as you say, 1 out of 7 sent sexually explicit photos or videos, and 1 out of 4 had received them. So I've had teenagers, 3 of them, to think about their friends, and most of them, all of them had more than 7 friends. Chance of your child getting one of these is really high, and be pressured into doing this. Often, you know, they're having their first or second or third romantic relationship, and, you know, prove to me that you really love me. Send me a picture of yourself partially mm-hmm. clothed or nude. Mm-hmm. And this has far-ranging consequences both psychologically and emotionally, because even more frightening, 1 out of teens report that they have done this, and then the photo was sent to someone else, or the video was sent to someone else, mm-hmm. or it was put on the internet. Because, as you know, dating relationships end, couples get into fights, friends borrow other teenagers' phones, and these things get out. And there's even reports of children, teenagers, committing suicide over the embarrassment mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. or the bullying that took place after these type of photos got out.
And then not to mention, these are underage pictures that can end up just about anywhere. And if it ends up on an adult's phone, then you've got other problems as well.
Yeah, well, it's illegal for those under 18 to transmit these photos as well. Mm-hmm. And it's just so easy. Most of this is done with mobile phones. It's mm-hmm. Stand in front of a mirror, push a button, and then push the second button and send it to someone. That's how easy it is.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, it's got to go to the developer or something like we did with the old photographs, or something like this couldn't happen. And so this is rampant. And once something is on the internet, or once something is out there, a teenager has absolutely no control over where it goes, who sees it, or where it ends up. And this has been devastating. And you'd think, well, you know, this more prominent among guys. Actually, more girls are doing this than boys by a small mm-hmm. percentage. And they're often pressured into do this and saying, you know, you love me. If you really love me, you'll send me this. You know, let me see in your bathing suit. Let me see in your underclothes. You know, it goes on mm-hmm. and on. And it can be devastating. And so now there's another talk you need to have with your teenager, and it's about sexting and talking about the risk and emphasize that it's not okay, and a series of conversations. You know, when we lived in Africa, people would ask me, how could I take my children over to that jungle? You know where the real jungle is? It's here. It's
right.
here. And it's very difficult to parent because of the environment that we're trying to raise our children in.
Mm-hmm. Now, David, this flu season has really been one of the worst that I can remember. And I know that there's been a shortage of Tamiflu and some of the other drugs. Now, the FDA is starting to warn about the risk of some unapproved flu products. What's happening with that?
Well, people will try all sorts of things when they're feeling bad, and that's one of the problems. I encourage you, if you have the flu and feeling really bad, to get to your doctor and get approved drugs and approved treatments. It's been an enormous number of young children have died from the flu. You know, we think about this impacting older adults that they, you know, get the flu, goes into pneumonia, and it takes their life, and that happens, and it's a risk. But it's also can affect any age, and including teenagers and healthy teenagers and healthy adults. And so if you're short of breath, your fever is not going down, you're having other symptoms from vomiting to diarrhea, anything other than a light case of the flu, I encourage you to be seen. I know the offices are full and the emergency rooms are full, but it's better to be safe than sorry. And if you get it early and get Tamiflu within 48 hours, you can make your case of the flu much less serious. And they are producing more of Tamiflu as they can. But I encourage you, especially with children and older adults, to make sure they're seen, because it can be very risky.
Mm-hmm. If you develop a little upper respiratory cough and that, and you get some antibiotics for that, and how long, you know, can that last when you're just coughing and feeling kind of miserable? I mean, that is that flu related or is that not flu related?
No, flu is different than a cold or other things that we okay. call it. You're going to have a lot of aches. It's not going to be so much upper respiratory as fever, just hurting all over, maybe a mild cough, maybe a little bit of runny nose, but that's not the primary symptom. Temperature is going to go up, and you're going to be saying, "I got to go to bed. I just feel rotten." Whereas a cold, you can push on and, you know, manage it. And frankly, Bill, docs are not prescribing antibiotics, and they shouldn't be as much, because we give antibiotics too often for viral illnesses, which they make no difference in. Mm-hmm. And what's happening with that is when you really need an antibiotic, you're not sensitive to it any longer because your body doesn't respond because it's already been exposed to that antibiotic. So, and they've built up resistance. So we're really trying to move back from, you know, I've got a cold, I've got upper respiratory, I've got my sinuses are full, until it's very obvious that this is a bacterial infection and not just a viral infection, because the problem is we're using way too many antibiotics and more bugs become resistant to them, and there's fewer that can really take care of serious diseases now, and we're concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. David, the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, I think it's what that started about 14 years ago.
It did.
Which is basically saying yes to stem cell research. Talk about what's been going on with that.
Well, stem cell research is what we call regenerative medicine. We can replace damaged cells or tissues, and it has tremendous potential. The question is not whether we should be doing stem cell research. The question is, where do we get the stem cells? And many mm-hmm. people remember that battle over, let's sacrifice embryos, little human beings, for their valuable biological parts. And the big debate that took place in the early 2000s to, you know, until finally they allowed this to happen. And the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine put out, through the government, put out a bond issue and got $3 billion. They're going to lead the way through this. And we're going to have all these wonderful cures. Now it's 14 years later, and there's not been one cure from embryonic stem cell research.
Wow.
They've spent $2.5 billion, and they promised that they would get $1 billion back in royalty. Well, just this week, they got their first check for $200,000.
That's short of a billion. I was terrible at math, but that's short of a billion.
It's like you loan somebody $1,000 and they promise to pay you back and you gave them 20 cents. Would you be celebrating it? That's what this was compared to how much money had been promised back. And that's not even because there's a cure. They've got a stage one trial for one disease. Where we're finding real results for real people is with adult stem cells and what we call induced pluripotent cells. Those are cells from anywhere in your body that they can genetically modify to act like a stem cell. So they match your tissue. If they work and help you, you don't have to take therapy to avoid rejection. And there are over 70 cures out there already with adult stem cells. And this California Institute's still putting its money where its ideology is, but not where the cures are, and wasting it.
Yeah, the royalty check was, I guess, for a potential therapy for a glioblastoma, which is obviously a deadly brain tumor, so that's good. But it's not even on the market yet.
No, it's not. It's stage one's trial, and they're trying to make sure that it doesn't harm the patient to even attempt this.
Uh-huh.
And the problem with these type of cells in the embryonic form is they act like cancer. That's been one of the big problems. And they grow and turn into all sorts of tissues. So you put them in the brain to deal with this type, Parkinson's disease or whatever. And what they do or tend to do is to cause cancer cells. And that's what cancers are. They're uncontrollable population of cells that just continues to grow and grow, and that's what can happen with these. So that's a problem. Where do you get the embryos? We did a study, and a mathematical study, and looked at it. If you tried to cure diabetes with embryonic stem cells, you'd have to have 80 million women give their embryos to just treat type 1 diabetes in this country. So, I mean, it's just practically it doesn't work.
No.
So we need to put our money where we're going to get cures and not, go over top of ethical considerations of destroying human life to do it.
Yeah, David, thanks so much for being on the show. Always look forward to our conversations. Have a great day.
Okay.
All right. It's 27 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and go to Breakpoint.
Are gonna clear up, put on a happy face.
It is 32 minutes after the hour. We're gonna go to news, and then when we come back, Dr. Paul Kingor is gonna be with us. So we'll be back with him in about 7 minutes.
That gloomy mask of tragedy.
Yeah.
It's not your style.
No. 23 minutes until the top of the hour, Arlene Pelican. A speaker and an author. She says we can't have our nose buried in our phones when we're apologizing to someone. Here she outlines Dr. Gary Chapman's 5 steps to a proper apology.
First, step one is expressing regret. I am sorry. The step two is accepting responsibility. I was wrong for snapping at you at breakfast, or whatever it was. And I take responsibility. I'm the one. I was wrong about that. Making restitution is your third step. What can I do to make it right? What can I do? Do I need to take you to dinner? Do I need to, tell the third party that was involved that was there? Do I need to let them know, I said something very offensive the other day and I have to apologize for that. How can I make restitution? The fourth step is genuinely repenting. I'll try my best not to do that again. And that last step, requesting forgiveness, will you please forgive me?
If you want to hear more of that interview with Arlene Pelican, head over to myfaithradio.com and you can type in her name, Pelican, just the way it sounds, or also, do you know how to apologize? We'll take a short break, and then when we come back, Dr. Paul Kingor is going to be with us. Look forward to that in just a minute.
Do you find yourself disappointed at times? Like you can't measure up to your expectations? You're probably rolling your eyes right now thinking, of course, life is hard. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Yes, life is difficult. And in the failures, the struggles, the blunders, we're kept authentic. I run into many parents who want the world to think their family is perfect. And the kids in that family unit grow up learning that hardship and struggle are synonymous with failure and should be avoided at all cost. The better angle is this. We all fail, some of us more than others. The hard stuff yields some of the most profound growth in the long run. So, keep it real in your family, okay? Let's not try to breed perfectionists.
Get a free online parenting course called Tough Guys and Drama Queens at freeparentingcourse.com.
It's 20 minutes until the top of the hour. You know what bugs me is when people refer to themselves in the third person. You'll never hear Bill Arnold do that. Anyway, I have on our studio line Dr. Paul Kingor, and Paul is a regular guest, and we just love him to death. Good morning, Paul.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. I know you've been doing some writing lately on the gun control issues, and I would love to get your take on some of the aftermath of the Parkland shooting.
Yeah, well, it's for me, Bill, I think above all, I mean, whether it's an issue of failure of gun laws or warning signs of mental illness or FBI checks or how the police responded or if they or how security responded or didn't respond at Parkland. I think that first and foremost, I mean, this just reflects the total collapse of our values and of civilization here in America. And you know, if you need any proof of that, just the fact is that, I mean, there haven't been church shootings and school shootings and other mass shootings throughout the history of America like there have been in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And even the last 10 or 20 years. And I mean, I have a friend of mine, and he's about 78 years old, and his name is Ron Coulter, and he often told me this not that long ago, and I wasn't surprised because I've heard this from other people about when he was in school in the 1950s, he would take his .22 rifle to school with him. And so did other boys in his class. And he would take it. He would put it in his locker. I don't think he even locked his locker. I don't know if they had locks in their lockers in those days. The school certainly wasn't a gun-free zone. And then on the way home, he would take his rifle, and the other boys would, and they would shoot rabbits in the field. They had a gym teacher at the school who would drive the fields with them with a shotgun. So and nobody shot each other. No one thought about doing a mass shooting. And people say, well, yeah, but if it was an AR-15, they could have shot a bunch of people. Well, they could have shot a lot of rabbits too with an AR-15. Right. I mean, right. Yeah, you could also with a shotgun shoot a good number of people. You could. I've got a .22 handgun with a clip that holds 14 rounds in it. You pull the trigger repeatedly, it's like a semi-automatic. Mm-hmm. You could easily shoot a dozen people with that, with mm-hmm. no problem. But yes, you know, so the problem here was back then, people just weren't inspired to go shoot up a school or a church. And another example that I give in a recent article I wrote over the weekend, my mother's parents, they lived in a little town called Emporium, Pennsylvania. It's about 2.5 hours from where I live. It's in the mountains. And every year at deer season, the town would be flooded by thousands of hunters coming up from Pittsburgh, from the coal mines, from the steel mills. And a lot of these guys were World War II vets. Today we'd say that they had post-traumatic stress disorder for sure. I mean, these are guys at Normandy and Okinawa and Iwo Jima, mm-hmm. you name it. And they would go from home to home on the street and knock on the door and ask people, are you taking boarders?
Wow.
And my grandma always was.
Oh,
and
my.
These guys would come into the house. She'd take three or four every year. They'd bring their guns into the house. They'd bring their ammo in. They would clean their guns in the house. They'd play with the kids. They would talk to the kids, complete strangers. My grandma would wake them up about 5 in the morning, make them eggs for breakfast. They'd go off into the woods and hunt. And it was never a single murder, not one murder, let alone mass shooting. So, you know, and that's in the 1950s that our liberal friends like to make fun of for being, you know, hokey and homey and Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet, right? But things were much more civil in those days. So it was never a matter of gun laws. I think this is first and foremost just a collapse of our values.
Paul, what is this parallel universe you speak of where people would come into people's homes with guns that were strangers and probably had mental illnesses and were welcomed? It sounds almost like something you read in the Bible.
Right. Well, and I think that there's surely a correlation here. You could probably draw a parallel, a direct line between when we started removing God from schools, public schools, started removing Bibles, school prayer, the Ten Commandments, you know, the teachings of virtue, theological and cardinal virtues. I went to high school in the 1980s, Bill. I graduated in 1984. We had a gun club at my school, and it probably people listening right now, probably anybody over 50 listening right now is nodding his or her head, saying, "Oh yeah, yep, we had gun clubs." New York State in 1984, the year that I graduated from high school, had 65 school districts with rifle teams.
Wow!
The schools were not gun-free zones. And I'm trying to remember this. I wasn't part of the rifle team, but I swear I think that our gun team in the wintertime actually shot in the basement of the gym, if I have that correct. And they used a target that was thick enough to absorb. It was probably like a 22 rifle. And yeah, they have to worry about the walls getting shot up because guys were usually good enough shots back then that they could hit the target anyway. Mm-hmm. But I mean, yeah, teams had rifle teams. Schools had rifle teams. And me and all my – still here in Western PA, people are going to think we're really crazy, but they actually cancel class on the first day of deer season here in the local high school because so many of the boys in Grove City High School hunt. And so it's actually a public school holiday or off day here in a lot of parts of Western Pennsylvania. Now, we don't allow guns in schools today, but we don't allow guns in schools today because, again, the complete loss of values here in 2018 compared to 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Paul, you often start a sentence with, in a recent article I wrote, I usually start sentences with, in a recent article I didn't write. And when I come back, I want to ask you about something teens today. Teenagers today when I come back. It's 14 minutes until the top of the hour. Speaking to Dr. Paul Kengor. We'll be back with him in just a minute. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Paul Kengor is a professor of political science and executive director of the Center for Values and Visions at Grove City College. He's also written many, many books. His recent, A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century, a must read. And I'm also learning about Paul that he graduated from high school in 1984. Paul, do you know what was Billboard's number one song in 1984? This will make a Minnesota connection.
You know, I could probably give you a pretty good stab at that. Talking about the collapse of civilization in the West over the past 50 years. See, which concert did I go to that year? Probably 15 of them.
Okay.
Maybe totally off the top of my head. I'm not Googling it.
Yeah, yeah.
The Police. Can't you see you belong to me?
You're hurting the show's ratings when you start singing.
I don't know. What is it? What was it?
Well, it's a Minnesota connection. That's a hint. If that's a hint.
That doesn't help me.
Okay, Prince, When Doves Cry.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Let's move on to the article I didn't write. But as we talk about guns in high schools today and all the shootings, mass shootings, I just want to make the point, and I've made it before, but I'll make it again. In 2017, there were 3,500 teens that died from texting.
Wow.
And we're just crazy obsessed about gun violence in schools.
Yeah, I got to tell you, one of the scariest things I've seen is I'll be driving down the street and a teen coming down, obviously not looking at the road and looking at the phone. And, I mean, you can definitely heard a lot of people in a vehicle doing that. It's very true.
And very scary.
Very scary.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the fatherless culture that continues to be part of the issue. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and this is really an amazing fact that's emerged in the last couple weeks since Parkland. But and there's been varying data on this. I'm actually going back and amending an original piece that I wrote on this for Crisis Magazine yesterday. A number of different sources reported that what happened. CNN put together a list of the 27 deadliest mass shooters in American history. A couple sources have reported that 26 of the 27, Bill, came from fatherless families. And a couple of others have since reported that's not accurate. I'm going through the data myself, but I'll just say this. The vast majority of these 27 came from fatherless families. And to me, it looks like at the very most, maybe four or five did. So we're at least like 80% of them came from fatherless families. And I mean, that is it's a shocking statistic, but we've known this for years, that kids that come from fatherless families, and here I'll talk about boys especially, that the highest correlation of all factors among men in prison is not whether they have a college degree or a high school diploma. It's not their income level. It's not their racial or ethnic background. It's whether or not they had a father, a dad at home. The numbers are just off the charts. And so now we have another even scarier category to add to all of this. Right? I mean, they more often end up on drugs. They more often end up physically and mentally unhealthy. They economically also divorce themselves. In fact, so many of the girls that were raised in fatherless families, it's a much higher percentage of divorce, of unwed births. And so now we could add another dubious category or correlation to this. Apparently, the majority of fatherless shooters, mass shooters, come from fatherless families.
Mm-hmm. Paul, talk about the eloquent comments the then-Senator Barack Obama made about fathers.
Yeah, and this was in 2008, Father's Day 2008, and he said, and this is spot on, quote, "We know the statistics. Children who grow up without a father are five times more likely to live in poverty and commit crime, nine times more likely to drop out of schools, 20 times more likely, wow, to end up in prison." That's off the charts.
That's off the charts.
Yeah, they are more likely to have behavioral problems, run away from home, become teenage parents themselves. And then he said, "Of all the rocks upon which we build our lives, family is the most important." And then this, Bill, and this really nails it. This was the whole point of my article. "If we are honest with ourselves," said Obama, "we'll admit that too many fathers are missing. They're missing from too many lives and too many homes." And what I'm arguing in this piece in particular is, well, if that's the case, why are liberals, including Barack Obama, suddenly pushing for fatherless families? And people listening are probably thinking, well, come on, Ken Gore, they're not doing that, right? That's a cheap shot. Well, no. They're on fire for same-sex marriage and same-sex parenting. You go to any liberal website and they're squawking. Just go to the Huffington Post today, all right? They are squawking about how the best form of marriage and parenting they've ever invented is two lesbian moms, right? Greatest. I mean, what you really want is two lesbian moms. That's a great way to parent. Well, if that's what you push, understand that's going to be a fatherless family. And then you kind of point this out and they're like, yeah. Oh, well, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Suddenly it doesn't matter. And actually, same-sex parenting and same-sex marriage is even worse than that, because it's creating another form of family, and that is motherless families. Motherless families, because two married, you know, quote-unquote gay men, I mean, that's going to be a motherless family situation. Mm-hmm. I think of the Italian designers Dolce and Gabbana, who went after Elton John, and Elton John just went crazy over this. And these two guys are, you know, homosexuals, but they're totally against same-sex marriage. And one of them said, "Because I can't imagine being raised without my mama. I can't imagine being raised without my mama." And his point was, Elton John is raising his kids through in vitro fertilization and surrogacy parenting, by the way, birth, without a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what's happening now in this push for same-sex marriage. Whether they realize it or not, they are deliberately creating fatherless families and motherless families. And it's fatherless families in particular has been a pathology in this country. So again, be careful what you wish for here, liberals. This could have consequences you can't even begin to imagine.
Yeah. Paul, I would imagine, you know, kids, they need their father's eyes on them. And not only do their father's eyes put their behavior in check, but it also, if your dad was a little bit this way, he could look at you and you knew a lot, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, how many times my mom would say, "You stop that or I'm going to tell your dad when he gets right?" And that, yeah, you know, that stopped it. We loved our mom, but there were certain things that we weren't afraid of from her that we were afraid of from him.
Yeah. Paul, thanks so much for being on the show. Have a great day. I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
You bet. 3 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and wrap the show up. Special thanks to Dr. Paul Ken Gore. I enjoy him very much. And also to Dr. David Stevens for making Hour 2 so spectacular. I wish everyone a great day. Driving could be a little treacherous, so be extra careful. And I will see you tomorrow. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.